You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Of Kellogg's, good morning, the best to you each morning. K-E-L-L-O-Good. Kellogg's best to you.
That chirpy, cheery jingle meant breakfast to countless families over the generations. You open that box of Kellogg's Corn Flakes or maybe Rice Krispies, pour on the milk, and you've got breakfast. But the story behind that catchy jingle and that bowl of cornflakes, it's a bitter family feud. The Seventh-day Adventist religion, a healthy, holy lifestyle, and some sexual abstinence. It's the story of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and his younger brother, Will Keith Kellogg, both of them from Battle Creek, a story told by U of M medical historian Dr. Howard Markell in his new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And Howard, battle they did, which we will get to. But what was it that drew you to their story to turn it into this book?
Well, originally I was drawn to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg because I'm a physician and a medical historian. And I knew of him and his work. And in medical school, I used to read his magazine, Good Health, was in the stacks of the old Taubman Library. And so when I was bored or I didn't want to jam this fact or factoid into my head, I would read them. So I knew his papers were all here at the University of Michigan at our Bentley Historical Library. So I was drawn to him initially. And then the more I uncovered his life, the more I met up with his little brother, Will. And the story was so compelling and the conflict was so great. I love conflict. I love writing about conflict. I don't like it in my own life, but I love writing about it. And it just, the story just kept unfolding and unfolding and getting better and better.
So when the Kelloggs moved to Battle Creek in 1856, what was the typical American breakfast like?
Oh, my, Americans ate very badly by today's standards, whether it was breakfast, lunch, or dinner. But breakfast was often fried up, cured meats, bacon, and ham. So there's a great deal of fat and salt. Potatoes were often consumed, and they were fried up in the congealed fat left over from the night before.
So we'll make these potatoes really unhealthy.
Really crispy, but yeah. Really unhealthy.
Yeah.
There might have been mugs of cocoa and coffee, tea, sometimes boiled rice that was doused with molasses or fat. And it took quite a bit of time to make these meals. The healthiest meal might be a bowl of mush, but these whole grains took hours to boil and cook so that they were soft and palatable. But it was not a healthy diet by any stretch.
And it's certainly, you can tell that John Harvey Kellogg was extremely fixated on stomach and intestinal health from a very, very early age, which carried through into his medical school years.
He was the poor man. First of all, his mom, before they got into a healthier diet, made the same type of food that I just described. His favorite meal was braised oxtails in a greasy, heavy brown gravy, and he loved eating. And he ate a lot of candy, too. And he developed colitis, a bloody colitis with scars on his intestine. He developed terrible constipation and hemorrhoids. And one of the most painful things known to mankind, an anal fissure, which is a tear in that region, which does not heal very quickly because you open it up almost every day. And it hurts like the dickens. It brings new meaning to the expression, you're a pain in the fill in the blank.
A big part of the story, as well as the pretty rotten diet Americans had, is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, centered right in Battle Creek, and that's why the Kelloggs came to Battle Creek, right?
Yeah, so the Kelloggs originally settled in Flint from Connecticut, but they were a religious family, and this was around the time of the Second Great Awakening, and the Seventh-day Adventists were just starting their denomination, and they settled in Battle Creek. That was the Vatican of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which was founded by James and Ellen White. Ellen White was a self-proclaimed prophetess. She had conversations with God or testimonies with God and would then tell her flock about them. So there was a lot of Christianity. It was the Adventists, so they believed in the coming of Jesus Christ, the second coming, and only a select few, the most pious, would ascend to heaven, something that really disturbed John Harvey Kellogg as a young boy, wondering, will I be holy enough to make that ascent? And there were a great many what Ellen called health reforms, which, you know, Christianity in the mid-19th century in America had a lot of health issues connected to their spiritual and religious issues. No wonder, because their flock was dying like flies. So she had all these health reforms to have a clean body. That was your temple, so to speak. So you were spiritually clean, you were physically clean, you were sexually clean. So the diet that one ate should be a grain and vegetable diet. That's how she interpreted Genesis, for example. No meat of any kind, no alcohol or caffeine, no tobacco, no condiments, because this food was often tasteless, and a lot of spicy condiments were developed, you know, spicy mustards and so on. And so none of those that she felt were either excitatory or produced bad health. And of course, she also prescribed a chaste lifestyle where sex was only for procreation.
So young John Harvey Kellogg grew up in this religion and then got a lot of support, as you point out, from the whites in his medical studies, because they had their eye on him to be the medical director of their Western Health Reform Institute in Battle Creek. What was that?
You're right. He was their chosen one, obviously brilliant from even as a child or a young man. And they wanted to expand the health reform part of their ministry by having an institute of health reform where people would come and learn about the health reforms, eat a healthy diet, maybe exercise, what have you. The Western Health Reform Institute was basically a house, and there were some quacky doctors who gave boring, droning lectures and some very tasteless food. And those who came rarely came back. And so they were having a real, as we say in the hospital business, a census problem. They couldn't fill the beds.
And then John Harvey Kellogg becomes the director once he gets out of medical school,
right,
which they underwrote for him pretty much,
yes,
right? And comes up with an entirely new word to name the place. And it's a word that we would get, but he invented the word sanitarium?
Yes. He invented the word sanitarium.
And what was that new word supposed to tell the world about this place?
Well, the root of it, sanitas, which is Latin for health, it was really a place of health, or as he liked to call it, a university of health, where people were taught how to live healthier lifestyles in a way that was not reform. You see, he knew that nobody likes reform, John Harvey said. No one likes the idea of reform. But the idea of going to a university of health, people might be willing to do that.
Pretty good spin.
It was a very good spin, and he was a great wordsmith, and he was one of his great talents was the ability to write and come up with metaphors and similes that people would understand. And so he changed everything. He changed the diet. He made it much more palatable. He changed the activities so they were fun. He developed all sorts of exercise machines that would get the pounds off. There were sing-alongs and entertainment. And of course, the greatest feature of the Battle Creek Sanitarium, as he named it, was John Harvey Kellogg. He was just a brilliant showman.
So he was kind of a rock star, if you will, in the health movement. And when the place burned down, as you describe in the Battling Brothers of Battle Creek, he pulled out the stops and really rebuilt it and offered so many more services at the San, and I as he called it, and I had to laugh that the Sanctum Sanctorum was basically what the colonic room, the enema room.
Yeah, that was his special place.
Oh,
it's a special place. Yeah. So the San burnt out, the wooden structure burned down in 1902. He built a glorious and much better one, a grand hotel basically, that famous people from around the world came to.
Like?
Booker T. Washington, Sojourner Truth, Amelia Earhart, Johnny Weissmuller, Eddie Cantor, William Howard Taft, Warren Harding, John Philip Sousa. I could go on and
Battle Creek was really bustling.
Yeah,
I'm
it
sure.
was the number two stop on the Michigan Central line, with Detroit being number one.
Although I note, as you note in your book, cynics called the patients battle freaks. Everybody was on board with this.
Yeah. And they called themselves that.
Now, we have to bring Will Keith Kellogg into this. Is it fair to say he was the flunky, the whipping boy around the San?
Well, for a lot of his life, Will was pronounced poor Will, because that's how everyone referred to him. He was more than just a flunky or a lackey to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, even though he felt that way and wrote about it in his own diary. He was younger by 8 years. John never missed an opportunity to humiliate or physically harm or psychologically harm his little brother.
Going back to when they were
little kids.
Wow.
In fact, Will's memory of his brother as a child, this is an old man, but he's remembering it. On cold winter nights, John Harvey would put his feet on Will's back to warm them. That's his memory. And John would taunt Will and treat him badly. Now, Will was considered dim-witted, as they said. He didn't do well in school, and he barely finished what we call high school. And it turned out he needed glasses, and he didn't know he was nearsighted till he was 20 years old. That's one reason why the Will Kellogg Foundation is very interested in eye issues, and the University of Michigan has the Kellogg Eye Institute.
All right.
The other thing that he was concerned about were dental issues, because he lost most of his teeth when he was still a teenager, and we have the Will Kellogg Foundation Dental Institute at the University of Michigan.
There we go. Yeah. And he did work at the SAN, and then it turned out he was a genius in business and everything John wasn't.
Right. So, you know, you need always an outside guy and an inside guy in every business partnership. So John was the outside guy, drumming up the business, bringing in the people. But Will was more than a lackey. He was a brilliant administrator. And this was a huge place. It had thousands of employees. It had, you know, farms and kitchen and laundry and maids and nurses and doctors. And Will had to run all the, what we call today, human resources. He had to run all the billing, all the accounting, all the vendors. He dealt with so many people, and he did it all in his head, and he was just incredible at doing so. And of course, John could not only treat him badly, but he could trust him because he was his brother. But he never got the credit for doing that. He never got an accolade. He never had a formal title. And this is why Will felt at the age of 46, I'm a flunky. I'll never be more than John Harvey's flunky, is what he wrote.
I'm talking with Dr. Howard Markell, U of M medical historian. His latest book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And now it's time to ask about the cornflakes. Let's talk cornflakes. What led to the birth of the cornflake?
Okay. First disclosure, I love cornflakes, but I love sugar frosted cornflakes even more. The idea was to create a food that was highly digestible. Now, John Harvey was obsessed not only with how the colon worked or the GI tract worked, but he wanted to develop foods that were easy to digest and would not cause an upset stomach. And so he had a theory about grains that if you bake them for a long period of time at a high temperature, you would break that starch molecule into a simple sugar, dextrose, which is true. That does happen. And when you eat that, it would be easily digested as soon as you start chewing it and mixing it with your saliva. Now, the first thing he made was a Zweiback biscuit, a hard double-baked biscuit. And as the story goes, a woman broke her dentures while biting into this biscuit, and she wanted 10 bucks for new dentures, which was a considerable amount of money back then.
It was.
This is the 1880s. And John Harvey didn't want to do that. So then he started breaking down the biscuits into crumbs. That was okay. It was his first cereal. It was called granola.
Interesting.
There was another guy named James Jackson in New York who was making his own cereal called granola. Similar. His was wheat crumbs. John Harvey said, well, ours are wheat with a little bit of corn and some barley crumbs. The lawyers prevailed upon him, and he changed the name to Granos, which was still the wheat crumbs, and people liked that, but it wasn't a big hit. There was another guy named Henry Perkey who made something we now know as shredded wheat, and he figured out how to spool out the wheat, boiled wheat, into these tiny threads and then wrap it up into the biscuits we know as shredded wheat. And John Harvey tried to buy the patent for that, and it didn't go well. He was always bad at business. He had a deal, and then he wanted a better deal, and Perkey said, you know, forget it. And he made a mint on his shredded wheat. But John Harvey was, you know, always optimistic. He came back to Battle Creek, and he told his brother, we'll create something better. And so they worked with, you know, various batches of dough, and they did various things to it. They spun it, they rolled it, they flattened it. And finally, his wife gave an advice, let's flatten it even more. Let's make it like paper thin. And they baked it a certain way, and they actually had a mistake. And the mistake was John Harvey was called to see a patient. That's the way he tells the story, and he couldn't finish that batch of dough. Will said they were just tired and they wanted to go to bed that night. But Will was very frugal, and he put the dough up for another day. He didn't want to throw out that batch. Well, what happened is that dough became tempered, and bakers know about this. Basically, the water content evens out throughout the batch of dough. It's not just in little pockets. And it also becomes slightly moldy. It's not moldy enough to alter the taste, but it's slightly moldy. And so when they rolled out that batch, it came out in perfect flakes when they carved it up and they had it.
As we go through your book, you know, you would think that this would be John Harvey Kellogg's triumph, but ultimately there was a huge legal battle. And how did it wind up that Will Keith got the rights to the family name? And it was, when we think of the company producing the cereals, and boy, it is something. $14 billion a year.
It's a huge international corporation to this day.
How did that wind up in Will Keith's domain?
Well, Will was, you know, working with him, even though John Harvey took the original patent in the 1890s on flaked cereals. Will was right there and was more than just an assistant. He was coming up with new things all the time. And part of Will's genius was not only his administrative ability, his palate was perfect. He really knew what tasted good. And so the original flakes were made out of wheat, which didn't taste all that well. And then he used corn because it was cheaper and sweeter. And you had to do all sorts of machinations to make corn flakes. And Will worked that out. And then Will left his brother's employ in 1906. I'm going to start my own company. It was called the Battle Creek Toasted Corn Flake Company. We now know it as Kellogg's. And he bought the rights for the corn flakes and the patent. And John Harvey got a ton of corn flake dividends, which made him later on a very wealthy man. And Will added a little bit of salt and a little bit of sugar, and that made corn flakes taste like corn flakes. And that just became the hit of the century. It was started in 1906, but everyone loved it. Will advertised to a fare thee well in all sorts of creative ways. He surrounded himself with brilliant advertising men. They knew how to sell the grocers and the food jobbers and so on. And everywhere you turned was an ad for Kellogg's cornflakes. And of course, American mothers loved it because now you could just pour cereal out of a box.
You weren't up at 4 a.m. lighting fires.
Right.
To make the mush.
And even dad could make cereal.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things coalesced at that time to make Kellogg so popular. You had train travel, you had national branding, and you had clean, pasteurized milk on a national basis. So you got to have milk to have a bowl of cornflakes, right? So cornflakes just became the hit of the century. Now, the doctor didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that his brother was successful. And so the doctor came out with his own line of cereals, also called Kellogg's, and they didn't taste as good. And that bothered Will, who had a fiduciary responsibility to his company to battle off people like that. And Will was very good at fending off competitors. He was quite the businessman. And so it turned out to be a giant lawsuit. It started in 1910. It went all the way to 1920. Will sued John Harvey, John Harvey sued Will, and on and on and on. And it went all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And the question was precisely what you ask: who had the rights to the name Kellogg? Who was the real Kellogg that could advertise their wares? And gosh darn it, Will won because the judge said, look at all these ads, millions and millions of dollars of ads. Millions of Americans read these ads or hear about it on the radio, et cetera. And when you hear the name Kellogg, you think Kellogg's cornflakes.
They never spoke again, did they?
Well, they spoke occasionally, but rarely.
Not well.
And they had terrible fights. Their last meeting a few months before John Harvey died, John wanted some money to save the ailing sanitarium, which really went under during the Depression. Will wanted to close it down because, as he dealt with his business enemies, he did not want John Harvey to have a physical legacy. It turned into an ugly, ugly fight, and then they never spoke again.
Dr. Howard Markel, University of Michigan medical historian. The book is The Kellogg's, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And there is indeed remarkable history in that cereal bowl as you look at your Kellogg's cornflakes. Dr. Markel has a host of appearances around Michigan this fall. You can go to his website, howardmarkel.com, and get all the details. Thank you so much, Howard.
Thanks so much, Cindy.